today on the Beginner Photography Podcast.
What I teach is not just how to license your photos. What I teach is what I call a licensing mindset. And so I want to help photographers like you and everybody else look at your work in such a way that makes you think all the time, who else can I sell this photo to? How else can I monetize this image? And once you start thinking like that, and once you start understanding the nuances of your industry or kind of adjacent industries that might be able to use some of your images in their marketing, then the floodgates open up. Then the doors really open and you can kind of hit the ground running and start making some money.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. Today, we're going to learn how to license our photos. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, a weekly podcast for those who believe that moments matter most and that a beautiful photo is more than just a sum of its settings. A show for those who want to do more with the gear they have to take better photos today. And now, your host, Raymond Hatfield.
Welcome back to this episode of the Beginner Photography Podcast. As always, I'm your host and photo friend, Raymond Hatfield. And we got a doozy for us today. Today we are learning about something that I know not only confuses me, but many other new photographers as well. So today we are going to dive into licensing our images with a photographer who has been doing it for years and years and years and years. Just a wealth of knowledge, and I know that you're going to pick up a lot from this episode. But first, I want to give a listener shout out to Meg for leaving the show a 5-star iTunes review. Meg says, I listen to the Beginner Photography Podcast literally every day. I'm just starting out, so this podcast really spoke to me. I feel so distant sometimes chasing daydreaming about becoming a photographer. So it is a reassurance that with my drive and determination, I can accomplish this dream. I have truly been inspired by you and your interviews with passionate photographers like myself. Meg, oh my gosh, I am rooting for you. This is so awesome. Thank you for sharing your story and, you know, how the podcast is helping you. It is my goal, obviously. I truly believe that, you know, everybody can take great photos, and I want to share that with you. I want to hopefully instill that upon you through the interviews that we have with other photographers who have made it. You know, you've heard plenty of photographers talk about, you know, starting at a day job and then, you know, just continuing to work at it and learning their craft and mastering it until they were able to, you know, take their photography skills full time. And that is my only wish for you as well, if that's what you're looking for. So if you're listening and, you know, the podcast has given you any sort of value, I would be so appreciative of you if you could leave the podcast a review on iTunes as well. It's easy. It's free to do. If you're within the podcast app on your phone right now, on an iPhone, you can just swipe up on the podcast episode. And if you scroll all the way to the bottom, there will be a spot to leave an iTunes review. So again, very appreciative. And Meg, again, I'm rooting for you. So today we are chatting with Adam Taylor. Adam Taylor is a photographer who got his start, interestingly enough, in a completely different genre, in BMX photography. And as you're going to be able to hear, transitioned into, different styles of photography to then be able to license his images, which he's here to talk about today. So even if you are, you know, a family photographer, even if you are just shooting kind of your own personal work, I really think that you're going to get a lot out of this episode because, you know, not everybody wants to go into business for themselves, and I understand that. But Adam really breaks down some quick and easy ways that the photos that you may already be taking or how to tweak certain photos that you're already taking to be able to, you know, potentially license your photos. And who wouldn't want a, you know, few extra $100 or $1,000 a year with the photos that you're already taking. So, again, I really think that you're going to get a lot out of this one. So we're just going to hop into this. Oh, you know what? Actually, I forgot to mention, premium members are going to get a ton out of this episode today. As you can imagine, when it comes to licensing your images, that is probably more of a professional skill or skill for professionals, those who are looking to make money. So this week, premium members who always get extra information each week in the extended interview on how to make money with your camera, you are going to hear how to find the decision makers who are actually going to be the ones purchasing photos to license, how to set up and write a, you know, an email template that is, what's the word I'm looking for? Not guaranteed, not generated, geared towards, which is geared towards getting a quick yes, how to price your images to license. That's a big one. And then, of course, how to protect your images legally against any sort of theft. So a ton on offer here for premium members. And if you want to hear the answers to all of those questions, then you can become a premium member today and also get access to the entire back catalog of previous photographers as well, sharing their best business information by heading over to beginnerphotographypodcast.com and clicking the premium membership button at the top of the page to join today. Plans start for as low as just $10 a month. You can become a premium member, get all of that information. So with that, we are going to go ahead and get on into this interview with Adam Taylor right now. Trying to learn more about you, you know, one of the big things about you is that before getting into real estate and then later licensing your photo, you started off doing BMX photography, which is, you know, always exciting to think about, you know, high energy, lots of adrenaline going on. But I couldn't find anything out about what happened before that. So how did you get into photography in the first place? And when did you know that, you know, photography and having a camera in your hand was going to play an important role in your life?
I just got goosebumps even you asking that question. So I fell in love with photography in fifth grade. My mom took my sister and me to New York City from a small town, Louisiana. We went on a family vacation and she just let me run wild with her little point and shoot Kodak camera and probably 15 rolls of film back then.
Oh, wow.
It was a very distinct moment. I was on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, like looking up at the statue and snapping pictures and looking out at the across the harbor at the skyline and snapping pictures. And like right then I was like, this is what I want to do. So I came home from that trip just telling everybody I want to be a photographer when I grow up. Fast forward, my senior year of high school, I was on the yearbook staff. So I would walk around the school to take pictures. I would go get them developed. I would come back and kind of design and lay out pages with those pictures. And I was super into BMX bike riding at the time. Had been my whole life. And I basically said, if I could do this, meaning what I was doing for the yearbook staff, you know, take pictures, lay out pages for a BMX magazine, that would be the coolest job in the world.
Of course.
So, you know, upon graduation, everybody's saying, what are you going to do when you graduate? What are you going to do when you graduate? And I had like an answer in the can for everybody. I literally told every person, I'm going to go to school for graphic design as a backup plan. And then when I graduate, I'm going to move to Southern California and do whatever it takes to work at Ride BMX Magazine. So I went to school for graphic design. While I was in school, I realized that the designers and the photographers for an actual magazine in the real world are two different jobs, unlike the yearbook where the designer and the photographer was the same person, me, the 17-year-old. So once I realized that in college, which is so funny to think back of how naive I was, then I started to focus more on photography. And a month before I graduated, I got a call from the editor of that magazine asking if I wanted to fly out for an interview. And got my dream job working for the magazine right out of college. So about 6 months after I graduated, I moved from small town Louisiana out to big time metropolitan Southern California and started working at my dream job photographing for the magazine.
What a huge change in lifestyle that is for a young 17-year-old. I want to go back to fifth grade though, when you were there at the Statue of Liberty and you're taking photos and you're looking up and you realize this is what I want to do without having seemingly even seen any of those photos at that point. Why do you think it was that moment, or what was it in that moment that really struck a chord with you?
That's a good question. I loved being able to take what I was seeing in my head, frame it up the way I wanted to frame it, and then the excitement of I'm going to get to develop this and then share it with people. Mm-hmm. Sharing my work with people has always been super exciting for me. Even today, when I get shoot done with a photo shoot and I'm finished editing the set, you know, I bring my wife into the office and go through the photos and kind of have like a show and tell, you know, and, you know, tell her and show her all the photos that I shot. It was that idea of I'm going to get to share this with people. And then, you know, I got home and I developed them and I had all these stacks of photos and, you know, I would cut them with scissors to crop them, right? Because they were, you know, printouts from Walmart or wherever it was, you know? So I was like chopping up with scissors and it was just the coolest thing.
So it was a very much a creative process for you, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to visualize something, use the tools that you had to capture it, and then, you know, even continue on by cutting it up and doing more things with it.
Absolutely. And to elaborate on that a little bit more, the type of camera it was, I don't know if you or your listeners recall this, but there was an APS, like advanced photo system camera from Kodak back in the day that had like a little switch where it had three different settings for the different lengths of the photo. So essentially it would give you like a panoramic photo or like a normal size or kind of a crop size.
Oh, really?
And it was just, you know, it was just how much, how wide like the shutters were going to open on that piece of film. And yeah, you had to, it was like a different type of film. Like it slid in. You didn't have to like pull the little reel out, you know.
Uh-huh.
It just popped right out. And I think you could get it developed at all the same places. But yeah, so like even that part of the creative process back then was really cool. Of like, you know, I get to decide which setting I have it on, you know, for this skyline picture or whatever.
I'm definitely going to have to look that up. That sounds really fun and interesting. I remember you saying that right there reminded me of, it must have been fourth or fifth grade. I wasn't very old. My stepdad had rebuilt a 1969 Chevelle, and like I remember him building it up from like this just piece of rust to a finished car. And none of that has anything to do with the story. But he had a friend who was also into cars, and at the time, that friend of his had some sort of camera. I didn't know what it was at the time because I was in fourth or fifth grade. And I remember that he was taking photos at a car show. And then when he brought them to us so that we could see them, they were all panorama images. And I remember thinking to myself, this is insane. I've never seen anything like this. I was so young. But now thinking back to some of those photos, like he was still taking photos in the traditional sense where like whatever his subject was still directly in the center. So there was like 2/3 of the image just totally empty, and it was a waste of panoramic. But I'm going to have to look that up. That sounds like a lot of fun. That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. So, you know, obviously the visualization, the framing, those things were important to you. But when it became time for you to maybe advance and get your first SLR or DSLR, did you find any big learning hiccups along the way when it came time to properly learning exposure or anything like that?
I remember a lot of things. Let's see, where do I even begin? So I'm just going to talk this out loud because this is an interesting question I haven't had before. So, first SLR, I was a junior in high school, and my mom, got an SLR with like, you know, a zoom lens, like a kit lens, so that she could take a picture of my sister crossing the graduation stage. She wanted to be able to zoom in for graduation. So that's when I kind of adopted this new SLR. And then I kind of carried that with me throughout college. And so I used that camera in college. And one of my first big hiccups, funny story, I lived with a band. Any emo, screamo fans out there might know a band called As Cities Burn. I lived with that band as they were forming themselves. And I was taking their first quote-unquote press photos. And I didn't know what I was doing. I knew that I was always good with composition. Like I just had it in me. I went to school for graphic design. Like there was something in me that was like good with like arranging compositions and stuff, right? But as far as the camera settings, I had no idea what I was doing. And they said they wanted to take photos in this like elevator, like this weird like cargo elevator where one of the guys worked. And so I brought a flash. I don't even know where I got this flash, but I brought this flash and started taking pictures. And I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. It was just an on-camera flash, right? And I got the pictures back, and there was like this black line across like the lower third of the photos.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this? Like, I don't know what is going on. Like, dude, I'm sorry I messed up your press photos. Like, I don't know what this is. And it's funny because I was in college, and I remember showing them to this other kid who was like in high school, but his dad happened to be a photographer. And he explained how the shutter sync worked. And, you know, if you shoot a photo with too high a shutter speed or the flash, it doesn't stay open long enough, yada, yada. And so that was like a big learning thing that it's funny. I was literally just thinking about that incident like last night in the shower for some reason about, you know, how far I've come. And flash photography is really big in the BMX world. Like you know, you have to use flashes to stop the motion and all that kind of stuff. So that was a big learning lesson for sure. Around the same time, fisheye lenses are really big in action sports. So, you know, getting real close to the action stuff. And at the time I just had a kit lens, and I went to this like weird kind of like downtown camera shop where, you know, they sell a bunch of kits, and it's this weird hawker that's kind of hustling and selling you things. You know, you'll see a whole row of these stores in downtown New Orleans or somewhere in the New York district or whatever. Right. Hopefully people can imagine the kind of stores I'm talking about, but I went in there and I was like, oh, I need a wide angle lens. And he sells me this, you know, weird contraption that screws onto the front of my lens as a wide angle, you know, because I didn't know what it was. And I remember showing it to like an actual BMX photographer that I met at one point. And he's like, I don't know what that is, but that looks sketchy. I don't think you should be using that. But he wasn't like, he didn't explain like, hey, an actual fisheye lens is 15 millimeters. It's a different lens, you know, like he didn't explain that. So I was just like, oh, okay. Like, no wonder my pictures aren't very crisp and sharp, you know? And at this time I had switched to DSLR. But yeah, there was a lot of learning curve there for sure, man.
Oh, geez. So how do you, when it comes to these moments of like, what am I doing wrong? And, you know, ruining a band's press photos and stuff. How do you continue to just move forward? Because, you know, when you're new to something like this, a mistake or an accident like that can feel pretty devastating. How do you just keep moving on?
Yeah, for me, it was just keep your eye on the prize type of mentality. Like I said, when I was 17, like I knew what I wanted in life and nothing was going to stop me from getting that. And so, you know, for all those years, the only thing I was focused on was, you know, creating this career in the BMX industry that I dreamed of, you know. You know, while my friends were out riding and building ramps and stuff, sure, I joined them sometimes, but there was a lot of times that I was in my room, like, you know, building a BMX website or working on some BMX design stuff or whatever, because everything I wanted to do was just like, how can I move the needle closer to my goal? And so, you know, when those kind of incidents happened, it was just, okay, how can I learn from this? Who can I ask to teach me? You know, like, where can I learn? Obviously now, you know, YouTube is so prevalent and you know, you could Google just about anything. But yeah, I found a lot of great resources in just asking people. And thankfully, there was one of the guys that worked at that magazine that I wanted to work for who was very receptive to emails. And, you know, I would reach out to him and ask questions and he would give me, you know, little pointers and tips and stuff. So just, you know, asking the people that I admired really helped out a lot.
That is fantastic. I feel like that story doesn't happen as often as it should. And I love how, as you said, you know, you keep your eye on the prize. You look to the long term. What is it that you want? And now you're going to keep working towards that. But today you're no longer doing that. So tell me where that transition came from BMX to you just went right into real estate. Is that right?
There was a little bit of a transition in between there. So from BMX, honestly, it was the fact that I'd worked in the industry for about 8.5 years or so. And my passion was just changing and shifting. You know, I was getting older. And honestly, I found CrossFit. You know, I drank the pill. I drank the Kool-Aid, as they say. And I fell in love with CrossFit. And it's funny because I started doing CrossFit because some BMX professionals were doing it to get better on their bike. And, you know, they were improving their health and their fitness. And so I was like, oh, if I do CrossFit, I'll be able to, you know, ride longer and not get hurt when I crash. And then within about 3 months of going to CrossFit just about every day, I loved it so much that my mindset completely flipped where my thought was, oh, if I go ride today in a crash, I might be too hurt to go to CrossFit. And I just fell in love with it. And kind of how I, you know, fell in love with BMX and turned it into career, I started to do the same thing with CrossFit. So I kind of shifted from like shooting X Games to shooting the CrossFit Games. And I started getting clients in the fitness space. And eventually I decided that it was too much of a hustle and a grind. It was a little too competitive. It was a little too young, not quite lucrative enough of an industry where I didn't want to repeat the same thing I did in BMX where, you know, my salary wasn't very much. I really had to hustle to make any kind of money in BMX. And eventually my passion left because I was burnt out on it, you know, and I got too jaded by the industry and the personalities within the industry. And I didn't want to turn another hobby into a career and then lose another hobby essentially. And so at that point, then it was like, okay, well, what do I do now? Like, what can I take pictures of that's going to pay me? And so that's when I made that switch to real estate because at the time also the BMX and the CrossFit stuff was having me travel quite a bit. So, and I was traveling anywhere from like 120 to 200 days out of the year for like seven years straight. And I wanted to settle down. I wanted to get a dog. I wanted to be able to have a relationship. So I was like, okay, what would interest me enough to take pictures of that doesn't require me to leave and travel? And I really liked expensive houses, like, you know, luxury houses. And, you know, being a dreamer and a goal setter, I wanted to go hang out in these like multi-million dollar houses in LA to be able to picture myself in them, to be able to dream a little bit and to be able to kind of feed my motivation and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the idea of shooting portraits and weddings and stuff just never interested me. So I was like, all right, let's give this real estate thing a try. So I went that direction, but you know, it didn't last too long with the real estate thing because the business model, I just wasn't fully aware of the business model before I got into it. And I thought that I was going to be able to create art. Like I explained earlier, you know, I like that creative process, I like creating art. But what I found out relatively quickly with real estate is that you're not necessarily creating art. It's a different business model. You're shooting a lot more and charging a lot less and trying to do volume. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not getting paid a wage that will allow you to spend the time in a home to, you know, slow down and take your time. It kind of has to be a fast paced workflow. And yeah, I just wasn't enjoying it that much. But through that, I realized that I could take pictures for other people of the same type of spaces and get paid more and work slower and enjoy the process more. So that's kind of where the transition to working with architects, interior designers, and custom home builders came, which is what I'm doing now still.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's a big difference between working with real estate and working with the people who are essentially creating these homes, designing these homes. Oh, okay. Yep. Okay. Okay. So then, today you are in your teaching as well as how to license your images, which is something that I'm super excited to talk about. When you reached out to me and were like, hey, you know, would you like to talk about licensing your images? And I thought to myself, I don't even know where I'd begin. You know, as a wedding photographer myself, I don't have to worry about any of these things, you know? And it is a question that I see that kind of continues to come up in the Beginner Photography Podcast community, the Facebook group and whatnot. So before we dive into the licensing side of things, can you tell me as if I was 5 years old, as if a five-year-old came up to you and said, you know, what is licensing photos? Like, how does that work? What would you say to them?
Yeah, good question. So starting at the beginning here, when you as a photographer sell your photos, you're actually just selling a license to use the photos. And so hopefully this five-year-old uses Photoshop, because I'm going to use this as an example.
five-year-olds are pretty advanced these days, so I think we'll be okay.
When you, five-year-old, when you purchase Frozen 2 on your Apple TV, you are don't own that movie. You cannot give that movie to all your friends that also want to watch Frozen 2. So that's the three-year-old version, because my daughter loves Frozen 2. But you know, as photographers, we all use the Adobe Creative Suite and different software, Microsoft Word and Excel, those kind of things. When you buy these software programs, you're not buying them, right? You're licensing them. And every year you pay for a new license, and your license is for you to use in your home and your business. And if you had a business with a bunch of employees and they were all going to use it, you would pay a different licensing rate. You would pay more to use that same software. But again, you still can't give it to everybody, right? So when you sell your photos, you're selling a license to use the photos for a specific reason. For me, you know, an interior designer hires me and she pays or he pays to use the photos to market their own business. And the license that I sell to them doesn't allow them to distribute the photos or give them to other people. So if I shoot a kitchen for an interior designer and she wants to use that for her website or a magazine ad, that's great. But if that same picture of a kitchen wants to be used by the company that manufactured the faucet or that made the cabinets or that manufactured the tiles on the backsplash, all those companies, if they want to use them, they would also have to pay for a license to use those photos.
From you.
From me. That's correct. Yep. So I am the copyright holder as the creator of the image by U.S. law. I hold the copyright. Obviously, there's caveats. And let me put a big disclaimer here. I'm not a lawyer. Don't take legal advice from me. But, you know, in the U.S., you own the copyright when you shoot the photo. If you have a contract with a client that says you're going to do a copyright transfer or something like that, that's a little bit different. But most photographers don't work like that.
Right. You know.
So, yeah, if the cabinet manufacturer, if the tile company wants to use those photos, they would have to come to me and negotiate a licensing rate from me to use those images.
Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos. That was a very clear example that made a lot of sense. And it's funny, I guess without even realizing it, I've kind of been giving that example to my couples. Like when they ask, you know, do we have print rights? Can we, you know, do these things with our photos? I've always used the example of, which is very similar to your Frozen example, but it's of a book. You know, you can go to a store and you can buy a book, but you don't own the words in that book. You don't own that book. You're paying to read that book, to look at that book, I guess. So that totally makes sense. Why do you think that this is so confusing to so many new photographers?
Yeah, good question. I think just lack of education, which is, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is teach photographers, teach companies, teach our clients, and educate on what this is. And, you know, the idea that you quote unquote buy something or pay for something and you can't do whatever you want with it, it's kind of a foreign idea. The software companies do a pretty good job of, you know, monitoring their software, because the way that you have to download the Adobe Creative Suite makes it very difficult to give it to other people. You know, back in the day when it was on a disc or a CD or whatever, it was a little bit easier. You know, all through college, I never paid for Adobe. And even into my professional career, I still had these, like, you know, bootlegged copies or whatever that somebody gave me back in college, right? But as soon as they switched to the download version, they were able to protect their copyrights and their assets a lot easier. So just like the MP3s and stuff, you know, it used to be pretty easy to let your friends burn your CDs. And now with the music download, honestly, if I wanted to put a song from my phone onto my wife's phone, I don't even know how I would do that at this point. Right. So, you know, the fact that other industries and other platforms are able to protect their assets makes it a little bit easier. So if you explain to your client, like, hey, client, don't you use Microsoft Word? Well, yeah, okay, I do. Okay, can you give me a copy of that? Like, then they'll start to understand that. But because they have a digital file and they can email that file and they can upload that file to social media and they can put it on a thumb drive and hand it off to whoever else they want, or they can put it on Dropbox, like they have so many ways that they can redistribute your digital assets, your images. I think that makes it a little bit more difficult for them to understand that it's, you know, a medium that should be controlled by the copyright holder.
Right. Okay. So before we get into the money-making portion of licensing images, let's stick with the photography side of it. Is there anything different from a photography standpoint between an image that you would shoot for an architect or an interior designer versus one that you would shoot specifically to sell to, like you said, a tile manufacturer, cabinet manufacturer, anything like that?
Yeah, good question. If you were asking that question for real estate, the answer is usually yes. Most real estate photographers and real estate photos are shot very wide angle. You want to be able to see, you know, the whole room, which makes sense because you're trying to give people a sense of the layout of the house, how the rooms connect to one another. You want it to look big because, you know, obviously everybody wants a bigger place. And so those images are shot a little bit different than, you know, a design type photo. An architecture, an interior design photo are typically going to be shot a little bit tighter, a little more artfully composed. You know, all the details in this space will be paid attention to a little bit more as far as, you know, how the furniture is placed in position, like the staging of pillows or items on countertops and things like that. And so once you get to the, you know, interior design architecture type photos, those are going to be very similar and many times the same as a product company. Now, if a product company hired me to shoot specifically for them, I would shoot that a little bit different because, you know, 100% of the time, the focus point would be on that particular product. And, you know, the things, the space around that product might be a little less cluttered, for example. But let's try to make an example here. Say we're shooting a photo of a kitchen for an interior designer, and we're up against a back wall, and in front of us, there's an island with a sink and a faucet. And then behind that, there's, you know, the back wall with a range and a tile backsplash. So that designer might want me to focus on the faucet in the middle of the room, which means the tile and the backsplash might be a little bit out of focus. And as I'm saying this, I'm just going to use an example from a very recent shoot that I did here in Hawaii, where as we were kind of setting up the shot, you know, I was asking the client, how in focus do you want the background? You know, do you want it to be a little bit more blurry and the focus to be more on this island in Fawcett, or do you want the background to be a little sharper? That's going to, you know, change my f-stop, right? Mm-hmm. So he said he wanted it to be a little bit more out of focus in the background. So I did that. I shot at f4. The island and the faucet were in focus. The background was, you know, kind of blurry and out of focus. Very quickly, I switched settings and shot the exact same photo at f13 without even changing the focus point to where that tile backsplash was a little bit more in focus. And I was able to license that photo after the fact to the tile company. So the style of shooting is very similar. But of course, if you're shooting for a product company, you want that product to be in focus. You want it to be the star of the show. When you're shooting for a designer, you might accidentally get the tile in focus, or, you know, accidentally get the tile as part of the shot that your client wants. And then you can still license those photos to the companies after the fact.
See, this is why I love talking to other photography professionals, because this is, again, a whole new world that I wouldn't even think of. You know, as a wedding photographer, I feel like I can't even imagine licensing an image of mine to somebody else, because I feel like I'm capturing these photos for my couples. You know, and while I take the photos, it feels like these are their photos. And I, again, can't even imagine what anybody else would do with these. But I guess this is kind of eye-opening, is that you as the photographer, you, like, this is your image. You could do whatever you want with it. And even if you're being paid to photograph an interior for an interior designer, you can still use that exact same photo to make more money after the fact by licensing these images, which...
Yes.
Goes back to like kind of what you were saying before we started recording, the value of the photos that we take. And we're just leaving a lot of this value here on the table. But sorry, go on. You were about to say something there.
Yeah. So seeing the light bulb go off in your head gets me super excited, because what I teach is not just how to license your photos. What I teach is what I call a licensing mindset. And so I want to help photographers like you and everybody else be able to look at their work through a different light, under a different lens, so to speak, and look at your work in such a way that makes you think all the time, who else can I sell this photo to? How else can I monetize this image? And once you start thinking like that, and once you start understanding the nuances of your industry or kind of adjacent industries that might be able to use some of your images in their marketing, then the floodgates open up. Then the doors really open and you can kind of hit the ground running and start making some money. And so just to kind of give you a little example, in 2020, you know, here we are, January 5th, 2021, last year, even with the pandemic, I was able to increase my revenue by $35,000 from licensing photos that I had already been paid to shoot. And I expect it to be even more this year. So yes, you can be leaving quite a bit of money on the table. And, you know, as a wedding photographer, I would love to see a wedding photographer go through the course that I have and develop that licensing mindset, because, you know, obviously, like, my frame of reference is, you know, the BMX stuff I've licensed, the fitness stuff I've licensed, and now the interiors and architecture stuff. But I would love to see somebody from a different industry go through this to see what they can think of it. Because, again, I don't understand the nuances. I've had this same conversation with a few other people, just very briefly. And, you know, one of the first things that came up was like, oh, well, what about the flower person or the dressmaker or the venue or whatever? And the feedback that I immediately got without, you know, digging too deep into the conversation was, oh, well, all those people expect to get the images for free, or, you know, I have to give them away to the venue because I want to be on their preferred vendors list or whatever. And it's like a relationship based industry and those kind of things. And, you know, in my industry, there is a lot of that misconception of, oh, the designer thinks that they can send the photos to the appliance company to post them on their Instagram because the designer wants the exposure. And when that happens, it's very frustrating for us as photographers, because that appliance company is building their brand off of my images without paying me. And so then it's, okay, how do I get them to take it down? How do I get paid? How do I turn that, you know, appliance company into a paying client or whatever? And so I think there's probably some education that could take place in your industry and some kind of opening the eyes a little bit and kind of widening your frame of reference, and thinking, you know, who else can use these images. But kind of a little sidestep too is, I'm sure that there are some wedding photographers that shoot other things, right? And so here's another opportunity. A good example, you know, when I was shooting BMX stuff, just for fun one night, I went out around the town that I lived in at the time, Long Beach, California, and shot a series of photos at night with, you know, long exposure, like the lights lit up all cool around the city, different skylines and stuff. And I posted those on a blog post, and through SEO and just search engine juice or whatever, the blog post got some traction. And eventually a company reached out to me and said, hey, we are going to be part of a trade show coming up in Long Beach. We make motorhomes and like custom coaches and tour buses. We want to wrap our bus with a cityscape of Long Beach. Can we license one of your photos from, oh, wow, from downtown? And I was able to negotiate $1,000 for that image. And here I am, a BMX photographer, and I just sold a photo of my city for $1,000, you know, yeah, because I understood that licensing and stuff.
Hey, Raymond here, and we will get back to the show in just a moment. You know, as a photographer, you want to be able to quickly come up with creative ideas that stand out. So to help you, I put together a list of 46 creative ideas to get you out of a rut that you can download by heading over to creativeimageideas.com. And honestly, even if you're not in a rut, shooting any of these creative ideas in this free ebook will help you to think more out of the box and create something unique and give you that critical real-world photography experience. So again, head over to creativeimageideas.com to download your free 46 creative photo ideas now. With that, let's get back to today's interview. And that's a big score. Now your image is on the side of a bus. I mean, how cool is that? I feel like just taking a picture of me in front of a bus with my image on it would be worth $1,000 for something that is. That
yeah,
is
so cool. And to round out that story, I was actually riding BMX one day and just so happened to pass by while this trade show was going on and saw the bus with my photo on it.
Please tell me that you took a photo of yourself in front of it, though.
I think I was by myself. I have a photo of the bus. I think I actually sent you that photo.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I do have a photo of the bus. It's just an iPhone photo from a very old iPhone, but I have it nonetheless.
That is so cool. Going back to your idea there about, you know, wedding photographers, I think a lot of the pushback is that, you know, when it comes to weddings, a lot of the other businesses are person to person, right? So a lot of florists are just a single person. A lot of cake bakers are a small local business. A lot of venues, as you said, you know, it's nice to get on those lists, which I understand. You know, I fully understand that, like supporting your community to, you know, better yourself. But there's also a million other businesses that I can think of that maybe are not small or local that would love to pay for some of these images, like probably ring companies, jewelry. You know, a lot of the dresses probably, you know, when you show up in the morning, the bridesmaids are all wearing like some sort of like special robe or something that they got custom made. I'm sure that whoever made those would be interested in licensing those as well. So I can think of a lot of these ideas. And again, to your point, you know, whereas this last year it was tough for wedding photographers, you know, a lot of us could not legally photograph weddings. And, you know, a lot of people had to. It'd be nice to have that backup idea for additional income, you know, maybe going out and doing some real estate photos to make some extra money and then continue to use this information as far as licensing images, just in case, I don't know, another global pandemic happens or something else terrible happens where we're forced to stay home. Let me go ahead and ask now, because I'm thinking about, you know, there's been times where I've shown up to weddings and I thought to myself, this is not the wedding that I expected, right? Are there times where maybe you go into a home and you think, oh, this is so-so. I'm not sure if, you know, I'll be able to actually get anything out of this. Is there anything that you do to spruce it up, or do you just have to wait until the next home that you photograph and hope that that one's a winner?
Good question. Certainly when I was shooting real estate, there was many times that I was like, oh, I got into this thinking I was going to be hanging out in these million-dollar mansions, and this is a piece of crap. Now that I'm working with the higher end clients, there's a lot less of that. You know, there's certainly homes that are like more my style or less my style. But there are times, like, for example, when a builder will hire me and the house is empty and, you know, it's unfurnished. They have, you know, an interior designer hasn't gone in there and put their personal touch. And it's like, all right, here's an empty shell of a house. Like, this isn't very exciting. But to those kind of things, on every shoot, I bring what I call a props kit. So I have a big Tupperware bin with like little staging items in it. So I bring, you know, a little Turkish towel and some soap bottles and a cutting board and some fake fruit and some bottles of sparkling water. A handful of items that I can put into kitchens, bathrooms, or maybe exterior like patio type areas that will make it look like the space is lived in. So, you know, if a builder wants a completely empty kitchen shot, I can shoot that for him. But if, you know, I've got a little extra time on my hands, I might put a couple things on the counter, shoot that same photo with some staging items in there. And now maybe the cabinet company will want to buy it because it doesn't look so empty and boring, you know?
Right, right. Oh, that's a great tip. That's something that, you know, it just makes sense, but I don't know if a lot of people would think about that, but obviously it comes from experience, and that's why we're listening to this podcast right now, so that we can continue to gain that experience. So let's go ahead and switch up a little bit. Let's kind of dive deeper into the business aspect of the licensing of our images. So let's say you go into a house, maybe it was empty, you stage a few photos, and then guess what? You got yourself a winning shot here. Who are we selling our photos to, and how do we find them?
Great question. The people that you're looking for are the companies that have manufactured things that are in that home. So we've got tile companies, cabinet companies, faucet makers, even on the cabinet, like the little knobs and the pulls, like those hardware. You know, some of those are maybe just from Ace Hardware, right? But some of them are an actual company that designs those and, you know, made out of a certain metal and has a certain design to it. Tile and flooring companies, window manufacturers, fireplace companies. So basically every item you see in a house was a choice made by the designer or the architect and put in there for a reason. And this is going back to that, you know, how do your photos have value, or who are they valuable to? Every one of those companies that manufactures those products has a need for images to sell more of their products. So if I can break this down for us a little bit, let's talk about a couple of different types of companies and, you know, how they need or why they need photos and how they get their photos. And this will kind of help explain a little bit the value behind the images that we're taking, right? All right. So we've got a small company that, let's say that they make tiles, small company being, you know, mom and pop type shop, like a couple employees only. They need photos of their products installed in order to sell more of their work. How are they going to get their images? They can build a space and install them themselves. So what does that look like? They have to, you know, literally build like a little kitchen vignette and, you know, put tiles on a backsplash. They can maybe, you know, use one of their own bathrooms at their house and install their tiles in their own house or something to try to take photos of it. There's a lot of labor and planning and preparation involved in that. And if it's a couple person in the company, you know, what resources do they have to get that done? They can hire a photographer to go out and shoot photos. So what does that look like? That looks like, okay, we sold our tiles to this dealer in a different state. The dealer told us that they're going to go into a really nice house that so-and-so architect is building. Like, okay, track down that architect. Now you've got to try to work with that architect and or the homeowner and or interior designer to get access to that home. And then you have to call around and vet photographers in that area. Okay, who's going to be able to take photos of this place for me? Because I'm over here in a different state and my tiles got sent out to this state over here. How much is that photographer going to charge? Are the photos going to be good? I get the photos in like, oh, like only 3 out of these 10 are really good enough for my marketing efforts. That's a lot of time, energy, resources, money. The other option is somebody like me emails them a digital file and says, hey, this is going to be $350. Do you want it? And they say, oh my God, yes. Because my other options I just explained, right? So why would I not pay a couple hundred dollars for this image when I already see that it's good? I already know where I can pop it into my marketing. And I don't have to go through all that effort and work to, you know, setting up the shoot, building a set, whatever it might be. And here I have a beautiful photo of this particular tile to put in my marketing.
There are two ways to bring home more money with your photography business. You either get more clients or you spend less of the money that you make. CloudSpot Studio helps you keep more of what you earn. With the lowest payment processing fees in the industry, the average photographer will save $300 annually. And that's just more money to invest in essential gear like a new flash or a sweet camera bag. You know, one that is perfect for storing all of the wedding day snacks that you can pack. But it's not just about savings. CloudSpot Studio is designed to streamline your workflow. Easily organize shoots, send contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and you're really going to enjoy the hassle-free payments. So sign up for a free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com and As a bonus, you're going to get access to my exclusive wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires at no additional cost. Why let fees chip away at your profits? Empower your photo journey with CloudSpot and watch your business soar. Wow, that makes perfect sense. I thought in my head, you know, obviously the smaller mom and pop type tile maker, I wasn't even thinking about them. I was thinking, I guess, like, you know, Moen and Kohler, like all these like really high end or large faucet companies, and thinking to myself, yeah, I'm sure that they just have like several kitchens like in a studio somewhere where they just kind of exchange things in and out. But it's those smaller companies perhaps that that are too big to where they can't do it themselves, but they're not big enough to where they can have those set spaces. That makes sense.
Yeah. So if we're talking about the big companies, like, yes, they can build sets and they have the resources to, you know, get a product photographer in there. They have all these different avenues in order to get their digital assets. And so for that reason, they might not need your photos, but what you provide for them might be a different style than what they've created, or might be a new product that they haven't got around to shooting yet or something like that. So they still might want your photos, these big companies. And I've sold plenty of photos to big companies. But I've also been told by some of the big companies, or a big company in particular, I'll go ahead and mention their name, Delta Faucet. They said, we'll buy this photo, but we can't pay your normal rate because we just don't have that big a need for it. Like, it's not going to immediately go on a display. It's not going to immediately go in a catalog. We're going to toss it in our database. It may or may not ever get used, but it's only a couple $100. So we'll take the chance and throw it in the mix. So they, because they already have a bunch of assets, might not be able to pay quite as much. You know, obviously they have the budgets, but their budgets are allocated differently. So sure. the medium sized company might be able to produce a small shoot, kind of, you know, makeshift in their warehouse, or they, you know, might have the means to, you know, hire a photographer here and there on a regular basis, kind of thing. So, you know, their need, their value might be a little bit differently. So you can kind of start to understand your industry, start to understand your potential clients and who you're reaching out to, understand their business model and how they work. You can look at their Instagram. Do they, you know, have photos from other photographers, or do they all kind of have the same look and feel, meaning they kind of produce them all in the same type of campaign? You know, do they credit other photographers? Are they, you know, showing a wide variety of different types of spaces? Like, you know, essentially do your research and kind of get a feel for what's out there, so that you understand who you're going to be trying to sell to.
Okay, so then who are we trying to sell to? Like, who are we contacting? Because if I'm thinking Delta Faucets, you know, I can go down to Lowe's and they have, you know, Delta Faucets there. And on the back, it says, contact us. And then there's some 1-800 number. Is that who I'm contacting?
Very good question. And no. the people you're wanting to look for are the marketing directors, the creative directors, if the company's large enough to have one of those. But usually somebody in marketing. So you know, you're looking for marketing director, VP of marketing, head of marketing, those kind of titles. And in the course that I have, I teach all about how to locate the decision makers, because that's a big part of the puzzle. You know, finding the right person to reach out to, or the right person to get your email in their hands. That's a big part of what we're doing here. And it's a big part of kind of what I've honed and developed and, you know, worked on over the last couple of years in order to maximize my potential for success on this, you know. But there's a couple of resources you can use online to find emails. Rocket Reach and Hunter.io websites are pretty good. I use those in combination with LinkedIn and with Google. So yeah, I mean, like I said, in the course, I teach all about this. Obviously, I can't give everything away here, but sure, there's, you know, definitely some resources out there that can help you find the marketing person and, you know, the right people to reach out to.
Yeah, and I think your course is like 5+ hours long. Yeah, there's no way that we can cover all that stuff here in this this 60-minute podcast. So I totally understand. What about that next phase, though? Let's say that we do find that person. And you mentioned earlier, you just go ahead and send them an email with the file, and then you ask them if they want to use it. So there's no like big image reveal. It's not like, hey, I have an image. Would you like to see it and then possibly buy it? It's just, here you go, buy it, yes or no.
Yeah, good question. So my personal technique, and the one that I teach and that I, you know, give you ABC 123 step-by-step guide in my course, is my personal way. It's worked really well for me. It's worked for other people in the course. I'm sure other people have their way of doing it.
Sure.
My way is make it as short and sweet as possible. I have an email template that I use. I copy and paste from it. You know, it's only about six sentences long. It gets everything right out the way as quickly as possible. I attach the image in the initial email or images. I put the price in the initial email. Reason being is that these people get a lot of emails. They get a lot of people asking them for things. And they only have a couple of seconds to glance at your email and see if it's worth looking into. If the email says, click here for photos, or can I send you photos? That's one extra step that they have to do. If they have to wait any longer to do anything, you might get pushed down in their inbox. And that's not where you want to be when you're trying to make a sale. If they can glance it over in 15 seconds and immediately make a decision, you're going to have a lot better chance to you know, engage with them, get that decision. I go for what I call the easy yes. So instead of trying to you know, do a bunch of back and forth negotiations on every single sale, I kind of have like a standard rate, if you will. And some companies are going to get a lot more use out of that photo than others for that same price, but it makes it simple for me and it makes it simple for them. And at the end of the day, we're trying to make it as simple as possible for these decision makers so that they can move on with their day and they can send us money as quickly as possible. So I'll go back and say, the email that I sent you is based off the exact same template. And, you know, I reached out to you wanting to be on your podcast, and I knew that you probably have a lot of photographers that want to be on here. And I wanted to make sure that I gave you every bit of information you needed to understand what I wanted and what I was going to provide for you so that it would be easy for you to say yes. And so my question to you is, did the email template work?
Well, you're here right now, right? So yeah, it absolutely worked. It absolutely worked. I'm thinking about a lot of new photographers, a lot of photographers who maybe they're not new, but they're just not established as far as business goes. And there's no way around it. There's a lot of image theft in our industry, you know, even with companies, you know, taking people's photos on Instagram and posting them themselves on their own business Instagram. So how do you, I guess, protect yourself from, you know, you're sending them the photo, like you're sending them what it is that that you want them to buy. So how do you protect yourself against them just saying no and then using it anyway?
Another really good question. So the most direct answer to that, and I have to back up and give, you know, a little more context to this, but essentially when you email a company that is a professional company to some degree, you know, they're selling products, they're making money, they're, you know, established enough to have products out there in the world, and you tell them, here's a photo that I want you to pay for, this is the price, the odds of them actually using that without paying for it, I feel, are pretty slim. And I've never actually had somebody use the photos that I sent them in an email without paying for them. And that for me is definitely a gamble that I'm worth taking, A, because it's worked so many times, and B, again, because of what I just explained of, I want to make it easy for them. If there's a big ugly watermark on the photo, if they have to ask to see the photo, if they have to go through a password protected website, yada, yada, it's just more roadblocks between me and that sale. Now, to back up a little bit, the first step in protecting yourself is registering your photos with the US Copyright Office. Which is a little time consuming and daunting at first, but once you do it once, the process is, you know, kind of systematic and pretty easy to do. And it's very cheap and offers you a ton of protection. Once again, I'm not a lawyer. Don't take legal advice from me. But, you know, registering your photos with the US Copyright Office. There's also other image tracking services out there that a lot of people in my position use and I use as well. CopyTrack, Pixie, PIXSY.com. Image Tracker. There's a couple of services like that you can upload photos or attach your social media to, and they'll actually kind of like search the web for places that have used your images. And then at that point, you can either go through that service and you know, file a claim or basically use their legal services in order to help get your money, or you can go find a lawyer, or you can handle it yourself after you kind of see where they went. As far as Instagram, you know, in my position working with designers and stuff, what we see most often is a company like a cabinet maker will comment on the designer's post. You know, the designer will tag the cabinet company first. The designer will say, hey, that's a beautiful shot. Can we share it on our feed? And the designer's like, ooh, awesome. Like, you have 200,000 followers. Like, I want the attention. I want the exposure. Like, please go ahead. And they're flattered that the cabinet company thinks their design is worthy to be on their page. Of right. course. And the cabinet company gets permission, quote unquote, from the designer, posts it on their feed. And then I see it later and I'm like, what the hell? Like, so the first step in protecting yourself is having the conversation with your client way before that ever happens. So for me, the very first conversation I ever have with my client, we discuss this. The second conversation, we're still discussing this. When I send them my, you know, contract before the shoot, when I send them my invoice after the shoot, during the shoot, this idea of licensing and what you can do with the photos comes up numerous times, so that my clients, you know, now and going forward, all know about this and understand what to do when this happens. So that's a big protection barrier there.
Well, what about, and that perfectly makes sense. I get it. I think that's going to help out a lot of people. When it comes to the licensing your photos to a company, is it as simple as an email agreement, them saying yes, and then sending an invoice, and then you're done? Or is there any sort of contracts involved in that?
I'm going to wince when I tell you this. Once again, I'm not a lawyer. Don't take legal advice from me. The lawyer will tell you to get a contract and have a licensing agreement and have people sign a contract. I am trying to do better in this year, and I recently bought contracts from a lawyer to use, and I haven't started using them yet. So to date, I have done this for, you know, professionally as a photographer for more than, what, going on 14, 15 years now. And I've been doing this type of licensing that we're discussing here for about 2 years or so. And, you know, really doubled down on it in the past 18, 12 months. And to this point, I haven't used any kind of signed contracts. Mm-hmm. I provide an invoice that has easily read words on it, easily to digest words, you know, layman's terms of what their license will allow them to do. And again, that has worked for me. A lot of people don't feel comfortable with that, and I understand why. I'm a simple person. I don't like to complicate things for me or the people I work with. And so that's what I've done.
I love it. That was a very open and a very honest approach to, you know, how you go about doing this. And obviously some of the mistakes that you made, some of the ways that you're going to be, you know, trying to do this better in this year and make it even more profitable for you. And obviously protect yourself as well. Again, that's a huge thing that I know people are they're so worried about, that will stop them from even getting started in the first place. And then, you know, you just come in here with that little piece of information and just solve it all. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, that point of the analysis paralysis, or whatever you want to call it, you know, if something is such a big hurdle that you're not going to even start, then skip that hurdle, go around it, you know. And, you know, knock on wood here, I've never been sued. I've never had somebody screw me over. And, you know, I'm sure there's times when I could have made more money by doing X, Y, and Z. I'm sure there's times when, you know, a contract would have helped me because of A, B, and C. But at the end of the day, here I am sitting in Hawaii living my dream, and I'm making money as a photographer. So, you know,
you got to be doing something right. I love it. I mean, that's a perfect way to think about it, really. Again, so many people just get so hung up on the idea of just getting started that they don't. And I'm not immune to that either. Like, that's totally me. That's totally me. So if I was in this position right now thinking about the idea of licensing photos, one of the objections that would come up in my head would probably be something like third-party stock sites, right? Where you can just upload your photos to these sites. And I would love to hear your opinions, because to me it sounds like a whole lot less work than having to track down manufacturers and find the decision makers and come up with this and possibly negotiate a price. So talk me through that. Like, am I totally wrong here? Because the approach that you're taking is the exact opposite.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this. It's a really good topic to bring up. I started submitting photos to stock websites back when I worked in the BMX industry, because I was looking for other ways to increase my income. And I did the research, and I saw that there wasn't any good BMX photos on websites. All the photos at the time were shot by non-BMX riders that didn't understand the nuances of the tricks. So my hope was like, hey, let's get some better photos out there in the world and let's make me some more money. The process of doing that was very time consuming and tedious. You said it seemed like it was easier.
It seems like it.
But yeah, but you know, there was a lot of like metadata, keywording, like description writing, the way, like the specific way that the stock websites had you upload things was very time consuming and very, you know, system based. I had to get model releases from every rider, which I had never had to do before, which, you know, for me was like a weird thing. Like, hey, you know, I know I'm friends. I shot this photo of you a year ago. Can you sign this so I can try to sell it later? Like, it was awkward for me. Yeah. Later, I started submitting travel photos and stuff. And so I had several hundred, like probably close to 400 to 500 photos with stock agency. And from that agency, they had partnerships with others. So they were on multiple different platforms. And in about 10 years, I probably made about $2,000. And, you know, recently I went through and was looking at my stock photo sales, and there was photos that were sold for 12 cents, 36 cents, you know, like less than a dollar each per photo. And at that point, you know, I decided I just want to pull out. Like I emailed the company and said, hey, just take me off the platform. Like I would rather not sell my photos than to sell them for 12 cents each. Like to me, that's a slap in the face. Sure. And so the big difference is how you upload, the price you get, and then how people get the images. So the stock website is a wait and see type of thing, where you throw them up there and maybe people come to you, maybe not, which is cool. And it definitely can be a viable source of some income. And I'm sure there's people that do really well with stock photography and kind of have figured out how to work the system to their advantage, just like I have with my system. But my system is a very proactive way of doing it. And so it kind of puts the control a lot more in my hands. You know, once you understand who to look for, how to find them, once you get familiar with your copy and paste templates, again, that I provide in the course and that I use on a daily basis to try to sell my photos, you know, there's definitely some work involved in like figuring it out in the beginning. Obviously, the course helps you, you know, fast track that. But even for me, it's still, I'm putting in work. I'm not going to lie. Like I sit down at the computer for an hour or so and put in a little bit of time and effort. But it's a proactive approach instead of a wait and see approach. And again, I made $35,000 this year as opposed to $2,000 total over the last 10 years or so.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that makes sense because, you know, the amount of work that you got to put in for all those photos on those third-party stock sites, I guess I wasn't aware of how much work it takes. And I would much rather try to spend even a few hours trying to get, you know, sell one photo or two photos for a few hundred bucks rather than, you know, take 10 minutes to sell it for 12 cents.
Right. And then let's extrapolate this a little bit more. The people that come to the stock photo website, well, first of all, if they're looking for a photo, they've got to sift through hundreds or thousands of photos that look similar to yours. And you got to hope they pick yours. Once they pick yours, what are the odds that they're going to see your name and come back to you to hire you as a photographer?
Oh, right.
Exactly. Yeah. Zero. If you land in their inbox with a great photo and say, hey, I'm in, you know, the Oahu, Hawaii region, you know, please keep me in mind if you ever have projects out here that you need shot, what are the odds that they're going to hire you again for a shoot?
Much higher.
And I've been hired by other companies. I know, you know, people that have gone through the course, other colleagues and friends of mine that have been, you know, have built very long-term relationships, very lucrative relationships with companies that they originally got in touch with because they reached out with a photo.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So let's go ahead. I know that we're getting towards the end of our time here. So let's go ahead and kind of wind this down and let's kind of keep it photography related and talk a little bit about gear, because that's something that we don't talk about very often on the podcast. But when it comes to an entirely new world of photography that I'm not perfectly versed in, I know that there's always little nuances and whatnot. So say an interior designer reaches out to you and would a common goal be to come in and photograph an entire house, or would it just be a single space within that house? How does that work?
Yeah, another good question. It totally depends on that particular client and what their needs are. Very seldom do I shoot an entire house. If it's like an architect or a custom home builder, usually if they did build the entire house, there's usually like a couple of bedrooms or something that are just like, it's whatever. Like it's not designed that good. And with the kind of work that I do, 10 to 15 photos in a day, maybe 20 photos on the really high end, like very rare side. But, you know, we're not shooting that many photos because it's so, you know, time consuming and methodical and expensive for them, you know? Sure. And so shooting a whole house is pretty rare. A lot of times a custom home builder will do a kitchen and bathroom model. So it'll be like a small powder room that you get one, maybe two shots in a kitchen. And again, totally depends on what the client wants, what their budget is. You know, my recent shoot here in Oahu that I just mentioned with that, tile example, we only shot three photos in the kitchen. That was it. I showed up and shot three photos and that was our day. So yeah, it totally depends on what the client's needs are.
Okay. So let's say again, interior designer says, hey, guess what? We're photographing a kitchen and a bathroom that we, remodeled. What are you packing in your bag? What do you need to take with you to enable you to capture it all?
I shoot with a Canon 5D Mark IV body. Tilt shift lenses are pretty common. They're almost a staple in this type of work. So I have a 24 millimeter tilt shift lens with a 1.4 extender. A lot of architecture interior photographers will only shoot with a tilt shift lens. They'll have a 17, a 24, and I think it's a 48 is the next one. Mm-hmm. And then they'll have, the 1.4 and or the 2x extender that they can kind of swap those out. I also use a 16 to 35 millimeter lens, or is it 17-35, 24 to 70, and I have a 70 to 200. Those kind of lenses, but the tilt shift lens for, the beginners out there are going to allow you to shift your entire camera lens up so that you can get more ceiling or more flooring, for example, without having your vertical line start to go in or converge like a funhouse, which is very right. important in architecture and interior work. You always want your walls to look straight, not crooked, not slanted. You want your horizontal, lines on the ceiling and floor to be perfectly horizontal. So the tilt shift lens will be able to allow you to do that much easier without having to fix it in post-production.
I was going to say that Lightroom has the ability to automatically fix the geometry, but a tilt shift lens is what does it physically in camera so that you don't have to worry about things like that, right?
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you, I did it for a long time without a tilt shift lens. It got to the point where, A, I wanted to increase the quality of my work because the edges of the frame on a tilt shift are going to stay sharp, whereas if you're starting to expand out and, drag the verticals.
Get stretched.
They get stretched and get a little less crisp and stuff. But another big reason was on site with my clients, as we were setting up the shots, it got to the point where I was working with high enough end clients that it was kind of embarrassing. And I felt like an amateur to show them the image and say, okay, well, these are crooked, but you have to use your imagination because in post I'll fix that, And so I wanted to be able to show my client on site, like, okay, this is the actual image we're creating here. But there's some people that don't use them and just fix it in Photoshop. And like I said, I did that for a long time, but it certainly helps. And I would like to get a couple more in my gear bag.
Started, beginners don't need a tilt shift, but yeah. That's more of a high end thing that once they've been doing it for a while.
My opinion, that is correct. Other people will give you a different opinion, but that's my opinion. Yep.
Okay. What about lighting?
To finish that, I did it for a long time and made a lot of money without it. So you can do it. So that's my opinion. Lighting, I bring in different flashes. I use Flashpoint, which I believe is like the same as Godox or whatever. Yeah. I have two Flashpoint Explore 600s, which are big, heavy flashes that put out a lot of power, and then two Flashpoint speed lights. And then the radio trigger to fire all those. At times, I do wish I would have an extra one of each. It could be beneficial, but it's a lot to haul around. So two of the big ones, two of the small ones usually gets the job done. And then if it doesn't do everything I want, I composite the photos anyway, so I can light up one area of the room or space, and then move around the flashes, light up another area, and then we're compositing those in Photoshop anyway.
I guess that brings up another question. When it comes to compositing, this will be my last question for you. Sorry, I know I'm keeping you here for a while. When it comes to compositing images, how often are you doing that? Do you do that for every image or just windows with a lot of dynamic range, like with windows and stuff like that?
Personally, I do it with 99.9% of my photos. In this industry, if you want to call it that, a lot of people use the word flambient. So flash plus ambient gives you a flambient blend. Some people are against the F word, but we'll call it flambient. So that's personally and currently my style of shooting. Everybody has their own style. I don't have a lot of the dark and moody and kind of hard shadows and stuff. I'm not the light and airy where it's like all natural and super bright. I'm kind of in the middle. I would call my style a little bit crispy. I definitely go for the natural look, but at the same time, I want everything to be lit relatively evenly. I'm compositing just about everything. Every photo that I create, I will shoot a series of bracketed images with ambient light. And this is with the house lights off, because a lot of times the house lights are kind of orange or give off some kind of glow and don't necessarily add to the photo at all. So house lights off, shoot a bracketed set of exposures. And then shoot a photo or multiple photos with flashes, and then we're blending those in Photoshop.
Well, I'm not sure how to end it any better than that. I feel like today you have pretty much laid out a very comprehensive plan, or I guess lesson, on not only what is licensing, but a lot about real estate photography, what it takes to photograph interiors, and even how to make money. So I just have to say thank you so much, obviously, for coming on. Why don't you let the listeners know where they can find out more about you and obviously your course to learn to really go in depth about this situation as well.
Sure. You can find me on Instagram at Adam Taylor Photos, and my website is Adam Taylor Photos. If you want to check out my work, my email address is on there. If you'd like to reach out, I'm pretty accessible. The course that I have is called Learn to License Your Photos. You mentioned earlier, it's more than 5 hours of very in-depth scripted content, meaning there's no fluff, there's no ums and buts and pauses. It's straight to the point. We have also probably 4 to 5 hours plus more coming of bonus content, which is in addition to all the course material, it's interviews with clients of mine on the manufacturer side. The head of marketing of a tile company, interviews with a client of mine that, you know, we talk to them about licensing, just to get, you know, from the opposite end of the coin here, perspective, interviews with other photographers that have had different experiences. We have a private Facebook group that goes along with the course. It's a really cool community that, you know, we can all talk about this stuff and kind of share our tips and wins and tricks and stuff. So the course is at licenseyourphotos.com. Your listeners can get 25% off by using the promo code beginner at checkout. So just type in beginner and you'll get 25% off the course. And the ROI on it is pretty easy to track. You know, basically within one or two sales, most people make their money back on the course. And, you know, we've had people make several thousands of dollars by going through the course and learning this stuff. So, it really is a no-brainer. I think people outside of the real estate, interior, and architecture space will still get a lot out of it. The nuancey stuff is obviously, again, based around my experience and what I currently do. But the big picture stuff, the licensing mindset stuff, the way it's going to get you thinking about things, is all going to translate to just about any kind of photography. And, you know, I already saw your eyes open up a little bit during this conversation. I could see the wheels turning in your head. You already started to mention some ideas that just came to the top of your head while we were having this conversation. So, you know, the idea is that you hear those couple of ideas, or you think those couple of ideas in the beginning, but by the time you get through the course, that licensing mindset has really begun to develop. And once you get out there in the real world, it's just going to keep churning. I explain it like when you get a new car, or you're about to look for a new car, and you start seeing that car everywhere on the side of the or on the road now. Like, now that you've had this conversation with me, I'm hoping that the plan, the idea is that you're going to start seeing those opportunities more. And, you know, before your eyes were just kind of closed to it, and now you just have a little bit bigger, area to look at. And, you know, hopefully your licensing mindset will kick in and you'll start to see these ideas all around you.
There was truly so much I loved about this interview with Adam. I, as a wedding photographer, am just never in that mindset of looking for things to license. And being able to hear him talk about how, you know, just simple changes can really, boost potential revenue by just looking around and finding things that I'm already around that, you know, companies are going to want to get images of anyway. So why not be the person who provides those images for them? And I am going to go back and look through some of my wedding, my archive of wedding images, and just see, you know, is there anything that stands out? And if so, how can I do more of that at weddings going forward? So super excited. However, my biggest takeaway from this interview with Adam was just how great it was to hear that he started off in an industry that was nowhere near related to where he's at today, shooting, you know, real estate and architecture and product photography like this, essentially. He started off doing extreme sports, you know, and so many photographers I hear get hung up in the beginning, like, I don't know what to focus on. Do I want to do this? Do I want to do that? The answer is it kind of doesn't matter. You know, follow whatever you're feeling right now. Like, where do you want to dive in? Because right now it may be newborns, or today it may be weddings. You know, you may want to get into weddings, but as time goes on, realize I don't want to be that, you know, that 60-year-old wedding photographer photographing 20-year-olds. Like, maybe I should transition into a different area of photography. And Adam did that. Like, he did that. So it's just proof that it is entirely possible. And if it's something that you want, I say go after it. Don't let the idea of, oh, what am I going to do, stop you from moving forward. Move forward. And then when you get there and realize, you know, maybe your situation has changed, then you can change it up. That's what Adam did, and it worked for him. Now, if you are interested in learning more about Adam's course, Learn to License Your Photos, he actually gave me to give to you. So he gave you a coupon that's going to save you 25% off of your purchase by using the promo code BEGINNER. And I have the link in the show notes as well. So if you want to check out the course, head over to the show notes for this episode. Check out Adam Taylor's Learn to License Your Photos course, which you may be able to Google as well. And then you can use the promo code BEGINNER at checkout and save 25%. So again, thank you, Adam, for sending that over and offering that up for all the listeners. I would love to know what your biggest takeaway from this episode is. Are you going to change up the way that you shoot? Are you going to start exploring licensing your photos? Do you have any more questions about licensing your photos? If so, come on into the Beginner Photography Podcast Facebook group and feel free to ask your questions there. We are always happy to help. So with that, we're going to close out this week's episode. Until next week, you know, get out there and just keep shooting. All right. Stay safe. Love you all.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.
Can I ask why you decided to pack up and move?
Yeah, just to live the dream, man.
Really? We had this vision, that's awesome.
Yeah, we had this vision board of like what we wanted our life to look like, and a little bit of the backstory to this. I won't go too deep into it right now, but we were actually going to move to Bali, Indonesia for a year. We were going to like, quote unquote, take a year off and, mm-hmm. Try to figure out like different online revenue streams and stuff, because you can't legally work in Bali. I wouldn't be able to like make money shooting photos there.
Oh, interesting. But it'd all have to be online based.
Yeah, exactly. But we had leased a house over there, like on the beach, like with a pool, like, you know, super cheap place because everything's cheap over there. We were going to like live off the savings. And we had our one-way flight booked for March 29th. And then obviously, you know, it happened, COVID hit, forced us to stay home. So basically like we just had this big grandiose dream of like living this island paradise, you know, and, COVID shut that down. So all year we were just like, how can we keep this dream alive? How can we still make our dream a reality? And in the US, like without having to move to a new country, basically Hawaii is the only place that had everything that we wanted in our lifestyle. So, November 30th, we said, you know what? Let's just pack up and move. And I'm sorry, that was September 30th and November 13th, we were here. So less than a month and a half after we made the decision, I told my clients goodbye. I was in a retainer situation with like good, steady income. I was like, you know what? Money doesn't matter. Like, you know, our life and happiness matters. So let's go live our dreams and stop, you know, waiting till it's perfect, waiting till we retire, waiting for whatever to happen to create our dream life. And here we are.
That is so cool. There are so many people who could not do that, you know, whether it's the fear inside of them or, you know, that fear of I have a steady job. Like, why would I give all that up? And that is that's cool. That is so cool to hear.
Thanks,
I love that.
Man. And, you know, a big part of that, too, is we want to inspire people and, you know, not necessarily to move to an island. But, you know, hopefully through our story and what we decided to do with our family, having a young kid and everything, hopefully that inspires other people to, you know, push themselves out of their comfort zone a little bit and grow and kind of push themselves as a person a little bit.